Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, the latest on health and healing, we're going to talk about, does cancer grow more aggressively at night? And then, our brains are physically shaped by life experiences, positive and negative. A study shows medication is frequently and unintentionally given incorrectly to children on a massive scale. An ancient Ayurvedic herb boosts memory and reduces stress. The exponential benefits of eating less and much more on health and nutrition. From the environment, the sad future of our planet, common dreams. We're going to talk about what happened at the recently ended Peru conference. I said at the time that it may allow people to feel good, feel that they're doing something by being there and protesting or making suggestions, but that's not going to cause major corporations nor the governments they control to actually sign on and mandate. Well, that was correct. From Roberto Savio from Common Dreams. The latest on that. The six-step process to dispose of the poor half of America from Alternet. A newsmaker guest in the second part of our program, Patty Lavera, going to talk about the FDA and the USDA rulings on food safety in the Food Safety Modernization Act. And guess who oversees the food safety at the FDA? None other than Monsanto's former lawyer, Michael Taylor. And we're going to hear also how rich people don't create jobs from a rich person, Nick Hanauer. So we have a lot to share. Let's begin. There's a whole issue about cancer. Many of us believe that in order to understand how to prevent cancer or how to treat it, we have to first and foremost look honestly without any deception at all about our own participation in any inflammatory agent we take in. Now, that includes everything from pesticides and herbicides and fungicides and all the plasticized material that gets into our body. None of this stuff has ever been tested in combination. The trouble is we don't eat one bad food with nothing else. We eat about 220 chemicals a day that can cause cancer. Now, they won't cause cancer in one day, but when you're eating the same type of foods day in, day out, prepared in the same way, year in and year out, you're going to end up with cancer in all probability. So then we want to get off everything that can cause cancer, and that's not difficult to do. It's relatively easy. Then we start rebuilding the DNA, repairing it, so that whatever damage we did, we can turn that around or at least minimize it. And we're doing a lot of that. That's what we share every day. Then the question from a Psychology Today article by Dr. Michael Breas is, cancer tumors may grow faster at night while you're sleeping. I thought this was interesting. Quote, scientists studying relationships between different types of cells have encountered some new and potentially important information about how and when cancerous tumors grow most aggressively. According to a new study, cancerous tumors may grow faster at night during the hours typically taken up by sleep. Their discovery may point the way towards new circadian-aligned strategies for treating cancer. Researchers at Israel's Weizmann Institute of Science have found evidence that some cancers may grow more quickly during the nighttime resting hours than during the wake time. The findings came as a surprise to researchers who originally set out to examine the relationship between cell receptors, molecules that are involved in cell-to-cell communications. Okay, what does this mean? Why should this be of concern? Because in order to help the body detoxify, when it's in its catabolic breaking down cleansing state, generally between 11 o'clock at night and about 4 o'clock in the morning. That's when you're at the strongest end of your cleansing detoxification. You can enhance that. And you can enhance that by taking certain foods, nutrients, or juices about an hour to two before you go to bed. So my biggest concern was having cells in people who have cancer or are susceptible to cancer to take some certain precautions. Also, a lot of strokes and heart attacks occur in the middle of the night. So here is a simple regimen that I believe would substantially limit cancer's ability to grow at night, actually would protect you from cancer at night and from heart attacks and strokes. Coenzyme Q10 at 200 milligrams. Vitamin E at 400 units of a natural mix tocopherol. Vitamin C between 1 to 2,000 milligrams buffered. Bioactive quercetin at 1,000 milligrams. Curcuminoids from curcumin, which is from turmeric, but I wouldn't use turmeric. I would use the curcuminoids, ideally at about 1,000 milligrams. Green tea non-caffeinated, the capsules, or if it's an hour before bed, but you're better off with the capsules because then you get 200, 300 milligrams. And resveratrol, 100 milligrams. By taking those nutrients, you're helping to protect, and magnesium from citrate at 400 milligrams. You're helping prevent heart attack, stroke, and cancer, either preventing it or helping to prevent it from growing during sleep. I found this interesting. This was in Medical News Today, and it says, can external experiences such as exposure to violence, childhood abuse, or bullying change the physical properties of our brains? What about depictions of violence in the media, such as television or video games? And then it says, Medical News Today investigated what the adult health consequences, both psychological and physical, of childhood bullying may be. Among the adverse effects linked with a history of being bullied are features touched on these intriguing findings. And these included a long-term study this year of bullying that posited bullying as a kind of, quote, toxic stress measurable by abnormal levels of C-reactive protein, which last into adulthood. So being bullied by anyone, a parent or a sibling or an outsider, maybe 20 years go by, you are still affected by it. That's how it affects the DNA. And we've discussed epigenetic impacts of early stress turning on a stress reaction. Now, one consequence of this is that sometimes people have highly inflammatory, extremely defensive psychological reactions, and yet almost always they're excessive to the moment that the person is in and way out of context to what might be a simple statement by someone. And suddenly someone overreacts. And you think, wow, why the overreaction? More often than not, it has nothing to do with what happened in that moment, what was said or experienced, but something that was triggered from early life experiences where the person felt helpless, couldn't control the outcome, and therefore emotionalized it in the subconscious. And now, because it's subconscious, we're not able to control it, even to understand it, because it's purely reactive. It is not through reason and mindful reflection. It's purely reactive. And hence people say things, do things that in a calm period they wouldn't. And then this is one, it's not always the case, but it's one more way of understanding inappropriate behavior in people. Highly defensive egos, the inability to apologize, the inability to say they're wrong, the inability to learn the lessons of being wrong and start over. They just keep repeating the same pattern because it's locked and loaded, waiting for ability to express itself. So take that into account with what this study found. Quote, when I show that something is biological, it makes headlines. For some reason, I think humans are more compelled to believe biological evidence than someone saying, oh, I'm depressed. I don't feel good about this. I'm hoping that this will be a policy changer. The notion that an experience external to the body, not something we have ingested, that has been affected by disease or damage through physical injury, can measurably change the physical properties of an organ as intrinsic as our functioning of the brain is revelatory. And they were able to prove it. This was done by Dr. Tracy Valancourt at the University of Ottawa in Canada, who conducted these studies. So, in lay language, everything that happens early in life lasts the rest of our life. And if we don't get in touch with this, if we're not aware of it, then we become victims of it. So, do our brains physically become shaped based upon life experiences? The answer is yes, as do our DNA. And by the way, bad experiences in life make us far more susceptible to health challenges as we grow older. I was on a radio program late last night and early in the morning. It was in California, and I'm in New York, so I did the show. Very good show. The host was very educated on the issue, and we talked extensively about important issues. And one of the issues that was raised was a study that I did with four other PhDs and MDs, all scholars, all published in peer-reviewed literature. And the subject was simply, does the practice of medicine cause death and injury that could be prevented? And the answer ended up being, from their literature, not ours, there was no subjective input. There was no personal animus or bias. It was simply, look at the facts that they have collected, like the American College of Physicians and Surgeons, as an example. And we found that the number one cause of death and injury every single year, going back 20 years, was American medicine. The number of dead were over 10 million. The number of injured were in the hundreds of millions. For example, just give you one example, giving an antibiotic for the flu. The flu is not due to bacteria, it's due to viruses or a cold. Then every one of those has a side effect. You wipe out good bacteria, which then causes the immune system problems. So anyhow, we sent it out to 7,000 members of the American media, every member of Congress, every single member of every single one of the 50 state legislatures, and every major scientific publication in the world. We didn't get one single response. I believe I know why. I would subjectively suggest that, as the father of Gestalt said, a fear of knowing is a fear of doing. You don't want to ask questions in an area that may delegitimize your entire field to show that all the trillions of dollars spent collectively has been wasted. Actually, not just wasted, injurious. And that the entire paradigm, from the medical curriculum to how it's taught, to how interns are treated, to how everything in medicine has to change. Literally, because 80% of medicine is not beneficial, it's harmful. The part that is beneficial, the part that works exemplary, is emergency medicine. But that's only about 12% of all medicine. In any case, the issue was not that we found this and published it, and it's been cited an enormous amount of times, but not in the official medical literature, is that we will not face a truth that shows us the lies of our being. I said recently to a group I was lecturing to, I said, everyone is smart until they're stupid. And at different times in life, we're all smart and we're all stupid. It's being honest about it. When you're honest about it, then you can pull back and ask yourself, what is the likely outcome of about what I'm about to say, eat, drink, do, because it's an exchange of energy. So that said, if we stop for a moment, just a moment, and reflected upon the likely outcome of our choices, we wouldn't have a war on cancer. We wouldn't have a war on any medical condition, because it means that we have militarized mindsets that then allow those corporate interests and frequently very emotionally imbalanced individuals who are part of that to control the entire battle. With it's just like the charge of the Light Brigade, one of the most foolish charges in history of warfare and of the cavalry. But they were trying to prove something, and they all got killed in the process. So none of our wars work. None of them. The war on poverty, how's that working for you? The war on AIDS, we had success working with people with AIDS. So much success, we had a press conference to show the success with 100 doctors and 100 people who had full-blown AIDS who were in various states of recovery, and some completely recovered, and no one from the media came, especially no one from the AIDS establishment came, because it meant all their cushion jobs being paid for by the big pharma and completely codified and within the breast of the corporate liberal establishment would be threatened if it was shown that what they were doing was promoting toxic drugs that were killing people. So for those of us who are actually helping people with AIDS and writing articles on it and a textbook on it, they threw their animus towards us as if somehow we were doing something wrong by saving lives and they were doing something right by killing people. What a world we live in. That's the danger of how we think. So here's this nationwide children's hospital, and they took a look at 63,000 children under the age of 6 who experienced out-of-hospital medication errors, and they found that one child is affected every 8 minutes, always by a well-intentioned person, the doctor, the nurse, the pharmacist, the parent, the caregiver. This is how frequently unintentional medical errors occur. That's astronomical. Quote, this is more common than people may realize, said MD, PhD, director of the Center for Pediatric Trauma Research at Nationwide Children's Hospital, principal investigator on the study. So, we are not teaching the healthcare providers about prevention or health. And this is what happens when we rely upon drugs for everything. So just remember, if you think that our healthcare system will be able to help your child and without harming them, look at the research first and then be prepared. So when you do seek medical research, you have a support system, if possible. Not everyone will have that possibility, that can prevent you from being injured. An ancient Ayurvedic herb boosts memory and multitasking, reduces stress. From Case Adams, Dr. Case Adams, Green Med Info. Let me spell it for you. It's Bacopa, B-A-C-O-P-A, Monieri. M-O-N-I-E-R-I. It's an herbal medicine. It's been used for thousands of years in Ayurvedic, and it really helps those with cognitive disorders. It helps you reduce stress. It improves your memory. It improves your mood. And so anyone with Alzheimer's, dementia, memory loss, stress, anxiety, you bet, you can try it. And just new research at Australia's Swinburne University of Technology showed that Bacopa helps reduce stress and improves cognitive improvement. So one good thing after another, and so there's always good news to help us. Now, I want to shift over here and just read something. I'm optimistic on the future of the quality of life in the planet for those who are doing something individually and collectively. I am not optimistic for those people who assume that because today they look out of a window and they do not see a desert, they do not see cracked, parched earth, they do not see floods or mudslides, they do not see the tide coming up. They live, in a contented place. but it's also a place of denial. Or you're in a tower on the east side of New York, and you're looking out, and you think, climate change? What climate change? So for those who go to these annual meetings, which in my opinion do nothing, less than nothing, because they're actually harmful, they better get a different mindset. Don't confuse the integrity of your concern with the outcome, the results. The world will judge us by our results, not our intent, not our efforts. This is from Roberto Savio in an article titled The Sad Future of Our Planet, which I posted on our website. I posted personally over 100 articles early this morning, plus the staff and our scholars post another 100. So we're up almost to 200 articles a day and on progressive themes, and also themes that give people hope and empowerment, as well as hard-hitting investigative reporting. Quote, it is now official the current intergovernmental system is not able to act in the interests of humankind. The UN Climate Change Conference in Lima, which ended on December 14th, 2 days after it was scheduled to close, was the last step before the next climate change conference in Paris, a year from now. In Lima, 196 countries with several thousand delegates negotiated for 2 weeks to find a common position on which to convene in Paris in 1 year's time. Lima was preceded by a historical meeting between U.S. President Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping, in which the world's two main polluters agreed on a course of action to reduce pollution. Well, Lima has produced a draft climate pact adopted by everybody. Why? It carries no obligation to do anything. It is a kind of global gentleman's agreement where it is supposed that the world is inhabited by only gentlemen, including energy corporations. This is an act of colossal irresponsibility where, for the sake of an agreement, not one solution has been found. The big idea is to leave to every country the task of deciding its own cuts in pollution according to its own criteria. And everybody is aware that this is most certainly a disaster for the planet. To make things clear, all delegates knew that without some binding treaty to reduce emissions, there is no way that this will happen. But they acted as if this was acceptable, and even if it does not solve the problem, they believed it is like a hospital where the key surgeon announces that the good news is that the patient will remain paralyzed. The agreement is based upon the idea that every country will publicly commit itself to adopting its own plan for reducing emissions based upon criteria established by the national governments on the basis of their domestic policies, not on what scientists have been indicating as absolutely necessary. This, of course, is the kind of threat that no country in the world objects to. The real value of their treaty is that not the issue. The issue is that the intergovernment system is able to declare unity and common engagement. The interests of humankind are not part of that equation. Humankind is supposed to be parceled among 196 countries, and so is the planet. This act of irresponsibility is clear when you look at all the countries producing energy, like Saudi Arabia or Venezuela, Iran or Ecuador, Nigeria or Qatar, whose governments are interested in using oil exports to keep themselves in the saddle. And take a look at what the world's third largest polluter, India, is doing in the spirit of the Lima Treaty. Under the motto, "We like clean, but give us jobs," the government of India, under its Prime Minister Modi, is moving with remarkable speed to eliminate any regulatory burden for industry, mining, power projects, the armed forces, and so on. According to the high-level committee assigned to rewrite India's environmental law system, the country's regulatory system, quote, served only the purpose of a venal administration. So, what did it suggest? Get rid of it, meaning no regulations for any industry. The newly appointed Indian National Board for Wildlife, which is responsible for protected areas, cleared 140 pending projects in just 2 days. Small coal company mines have a one-time permission to expand without any hearing, and there is no longer any need for the approval of tribal villages for forest projects. Environmental Minister boasted, quote, "We have decided to decentralize decision-making. 90% of the files won't come to me anymore." Thus, the exercise of irresponsibility in Lima will also become an exercise in futility. Is there any doubt that if the people and not the governments were responsible for saving the planet, their answer would have been swifter and more efficient? Young people all over the world have very different priorities from corporations and industries, but they also have much less political clout. End quote. So, again, we will begin in the next 2 weeks doing a series of programs every week, one per week, that will show you what you can do individually and what you can do collectively to help save the planet. Because corporations are not, the governments are not, the state governments are not, they're all corrupted. And talking about corruption, I believe that we as a people, not individuals, there are certainly a lot of millions of individuals who are very compassionate, very concerned about those who suffer, but the majority of Americans are not, and our government is not. Individual legislators could be, yes, but not based upon our policies. The fact that we have now over 80 cities that have made it illegal to be poor, to feed the poor, to house the poor, for a poor person even to stay in their own car at night, shows you what we've become. The fact that we have debtors' prisons in 27 states, the fact that we have payday loans that can reach interest rates of 1,000%, creating debt peonage, the fact that we have manipulated student loans and we have indentured an entire generation of young people, shows our real mindset. Remember, I will judge you as you should judge me by what we do. It is what we do that determines who we are. Everybody can play the game of nice words, but who creates nice deeds by those words? Six steps to dispose of the poor half in America. And then I'm going to ask for you to call in and give me your thoughts on this theme. One, deplete their wealth. This is from Paul Buchheit of Alternet. Recent analysis determined that half of America is in or near poverty. By the way, that's inaccurate. It's three quarters. This is confirmed by researchers Emmanuel Says and Gabriel Zuckman, who point out, quote, "The bottom half of the distribution always owns close to zero wealth on net. Hence, the bottom 90% wealth share is the same as the share of wealth owned by the top 50 to 90 families. The United States has one of the highest poverty rates in the developed world. Not one. It has the highest. It's much worse since the recession, especially for blacks and Hispanics. From 2008 to 2013, the stock market, which is largely owned by just 10% of Americans, gained 18% per year. Well-to-do stockholders get capital gain tax breaks, including a carried interest subsidy Robert Reich calls pure scam. The bottom half of Americans rely on regular bank accounts, earn about 1% on their savings. Number two, strip away their income. Earnings due to workers for their years of productivity have been withheld by people in power. Based upon inflation, the minimum wage should be nearly three times its current level. An investor report from J.P. Morgan noted a direct correlation between record profits and cutback in wages. We hear occasional news about job growth, but low-wage jobs, the $7.69, $13.83 per hour, which made up just one-fifth of the jobs lost to the recession, accounted for nearly three-fifths of the jobs regained during the recovery, and it's getting worse. 9 out of 10 of the fastest-growing occupations are considered low-wage, generally not requiring a college degree. such as food services, healthcare, housekeeping, and rentals, retail sales. Number three, take away their homes. A study by the National Low-Income Housing Coalition concluded that an average American renter would need to earn $18.92 per hour, well over twice the minimum wage, to afford a two-bedroom apartment in, quote, no state. Can a full-time minimum wage worker afford a one-bedroom or two-bedroom rental unit at fair market rental? Over one-eighth of the nation's supply of low-income housing has been permanently lost since 2001. Little wonder so many people are homeless. Number four, hit them with fines, fees, and fleecings. The poor half of America is victimized by the banking industry, which takes an average of $2,412 each year from underserved households for interest and fees on alternative financial services. By rental centers that charge effective annual interest rates of over 100%, payday loans that charge effective annual interest rates over 1,000%, and by the growing prison industry, which charges prisoners for food, health care, phone calls, and even probation monitoring. On top of all this, bubbly TV personalities rave about all the lottery money just waiting to be taken home. Poor families account for most of the lottery sales. Five, criminalize them. Matt Taibbi's recently published book, The Divide, America's Injustice in the Age of Wealth Gap, contrasts the targeting of the poor for trivial offenses with the tolerance for the architects of billion-dollar financial crimes. The U.S. court system is flooded with cases for minor infractions, including loitering, including just standing near a building you live in, and these are part of the infamous Black Codes of post-slavery years. The buildup of arrests has added one of every three U.S. adults to the FBI's criminal database. The poor are criminalized for lying down or sleeping in public, for sharing food, for having nowhere to go. They become a criminal. Let me add on to that. I remember filming a man who is in his 60s. He was a Vietnam veteran, and he was homeless. And he said that he stopped at a veterans park and near Orlando, and he was reading a book, and he was arrested because he was a homeless vet. Now, had he been able to show that he had a home, he wouldn't have been arrested. That's what we've become. Number six, and most insidious, let their children suffer. The U.S. has one of the highest relative child poverty rates in the developed world. No, wrong again. We have the highest. When people watch the new documentary, Poverty Inc., you'll see that. Almost half of black children of the age of six are living in poverty. That's half. Nearly half of all food stamps participants are children. The number of homeless children has risen by 50% in less than 10 years. How many children, by the way, go to school and then when they get out of school have no home to go to? 2.5 million. And how many hungry children are there in the United States each day? 18 million. Early education is certainly part of the solution, for numerous studies have shown that preschool helps all children to achieve more and earn more through their adulthood, with the most disadvantaged benefiting the most. But even though the U.S. ranks near the bottom of developed nations in percentage of four-year-olds in early childhood education, Head Start was recently hit with the worst cutbacks in their history. Meanwhile, public schools in the inner city are being closed to satisfy the profit urges of the privatizers, who view our children as commodities, said community organizer Mr. Brown. After 50 schools were shut down in Chicago, quote, it has ripped black communities apart, meaning the government and the privatizers. Americans seek reasons for all the violence in our city streets. With so many disposable citizens deprived of living wage jobs, a meaningful education, and equal treatment by our system of justice, rebellion in the form of violence is not hard to understand. The privileged members of society would lash out, too, that they were stripped of everything they own and tossed in the streets. How would they react? Yeah, well, that's not going to happen. I'm Gary Knoll. Talk back, your turn. Give us your thoughts. We're going to take a break, come back. Going to have a newsmaker update, on the subject of how the USDA and the FDA are using the power of corporate interest to shape our food safety policies with Patty Lavera. She is the Assistant Director of Food and Water Watch, where she coordinates the food team. And Water Watch, by the way, is a group that represents we the people in Washington, D.C., and they're always looking out for what's happening as far as the big lobbying groups, the policymakers, to try to make sure our water and our food are not adversely affected. And she holds degrees in environmental science from Lehigh University and a master's in environmental policy from University of Michigan. And the website is foodandwaterwatch.org. We'll come to her in a moment, and then we'll take your calls at 888-874-4888. Please stay with us. Like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall, and we're going to go to our guest in a moment. Just want to mention that tomorrow evening in Rosendale, New York, my home used to be near there, just about 3 miles from there. You have a very progressive community up in Rosendale. It's out of New Paltz and Olive Ridge and High Falls. Anyhow, at the Rosendale Theater, at 7:15, they'll be showing Poverty, Inc. Now, because I'm doing an all-day special tomorrow, 8 hours, on our new reality of fascist America, police state, with all kinds of great guests throughout the entire day from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., I'm hopeful that all of our BAI audience will listen in, those who have an opportunity, because we have a lot of new insights. I want to get new information, and we have it, plus commentaries I've written. So you'll be hearing from Glenn Greenwald and Chris Hedges, lots of people. So I can't make it up there in person, or I would have gone. And normally I do one in Woodstock, but the Woodstock was not available, the theater, so it's being shown. Poverty, Inc., our final New York showing, is being shown tomorrow evening, 7:15 at the Rosendale Theater, 408 Main Street in Rosendale. Let me give you the phone number to call. And then afterwards, we're going to do a question and answer, and I'll be here in my studio in New York, and so we'll be hooked up so that you can see me and I can see you. And on Skype, call 845-658-8989. 845-658-8989, or go to on the internet rosendaletheater.org. It's tomorrow night, 7:15. Also tomorrow, I'll be doing a lecture. I've been working on this lecture for about a year. It's brand new, and I'm doing it mainly to film it because I've got a major, major work project that I must work on now for the next 3 months to get it done. I'm not going to tell you what it is. It's a really powerful project, and it's going to get a lot of information out a lot of places. In any case, I'm going to do this so I can then put my undivided time in doing my radio show, but also doing that project. So I'm going to do this lecture, and this lecture is about living an intentional life and how we all deserve to live a happy and productive and giving life and how most of us have lived lives of obedience, meaning we live the life others expected us to live. And that's why we have so much anxiety and depression and angst. So that's going to be tomorrow. And the film will be about 9 other philosophers and behavioralists will be filmed over the next month or two. And I'll have a whole film done as part of our self-empowerment series sometime in the spring. But I've only got room for 2 people. We were filled, and then a couple said they couldn't come today. So if you'd like to join me tomorrow evening, it's starting at 6 p.m. It'll go for 2 hours, 6 to 8 in Manhattan. Call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. Let's say hello to Patty Lovera. How are you today, Patty?
Hi, great. Thanks for having me on.
Patty, some of the major issues I'd like for you to explore with us is that explain the primary issues that small organic farmers are facing from this new round of FDA-USDA food safety rulings underway now, and who's primarily supporting these new rulings? Is it big ag and big food industry? And if so, who behind them? We'll start with that.
Okay. So actually, people probably remember, throughout 2010 and into early 2011, there was a big debate about a new law called the Food Safety Modernization Act. And so that bill was signed into law in early 2011, and it instructed the Food and Drug Administration to do quite a few things they hadn't really done before in terms of updating their authority on food safety. And when the federal government's talking about food safety, they are usually talking about microbial issues, things like, you know, bacteria, E. coli, salmonella, those kinds of things. In the food supply, they compartmentalize and they put other things that a lot of us think about as safety, you know, pesticide residues, things like that, they put that in a different box. So this was really focused on those microbial issues and updating FDA's program for this in the foods that FDA is in charge of. So that's fruits and vegetables and processed foods. This law doesn't affect meat and poultry inspection. That's a different law, different program over at USDA. So since 2011, the FDA has been working through a process of actually writing the regulations that will be in effect. And so we just finished a second public comment period. The comment period just ended last night on a set of rules that the FDA has to write to actually use this new law. And so the one that a lot of folks are talking about is specifically setting standards for growing produce, fruits and vegetables that are going to be consumed raw, basically, is what's covered by these new standards. And so they've now done 2 proposed rules that the public could comment on, and we just came out of that comment period. And folks are just talking about, are these rules going to be workable for all the different types and scales of folks participating in agriculture? We have a very diverse system of who's farming, and so that's why there's been so much public interest in weighing in on these rules, so that people can weigh in and say, this proposal will work or this one won't. And so we're seeing the rules change, and we're going to see what they come up with in the next round.
We might remember that Bill Clinton tried to include the use of human manure, sludge, as qualifying for organic standards. Now it is the use of raw animal manure. And why would the USDA want to include this in organic standards? And what are the dangers of using raw animal manure compared to compost?
Right. So right now, the organic standards, the National Organic Program, which is run by the USDA, is really the only standard that's out there for how animal manure is used in agriculture. And they have a very set procedure. If you're going to compost it, you have these standards that you use. You don't have to wait as long between applying it to the soil and harvesting a crop. If it's raw manure, it hasn't been composted, there's a longer waiting period. And, you know, organic folks usually are using composted manure. That's really the only place at this point we have those standards. If you are outside the organic program, there's nobody really looking at what you do. That's one of the things that this new law is trying to figure out, how these new regulations are trying to figure out how to set that standard. So in the first round, they had a really long waiting period, basically making it for farmers in a lot of parts of the country, making it hard for them to use any animal manure. In the second round of the proposals, they took that restriction away, and there was no waiting period. And so a lot of folks were saying, we need more science. We need to figure out the relationship between using animal manures and the risk of bacterial contamination of produce. We need to figure that out. They need to do those studies. But in the meantime, what is something we can be doing in the meantime? And a lot of folks were recommending, why don't we recommend this organic standard, because folks have been using it. And, you know, it's a system that has been working in a growing marketplace. And so I think a lot of folks recommended that yesterday to the FDA, and we'll see what they do with that advice.
Another regulation would be the quality of water used. And we can appreciate the concern over the quality of water used in organic farming, particularly in areas where there is fracking and near water sources with heavy industrial toxic runoff. However, this is added as a cost burden on small farmers. So explain the controversy over this regulation and what would be an alternative solution.
Sure. So this is another area where we need a lot more focus on water quality in terms of, you know, chemical contaminants. We're very concerned about what fracking does to water supplies, which is often being done in rural areas where we're also raising food, you know, and the EPA and other agencies are not doing a good job looking at that. This particular regulation that is being worked on right now is again focused on those microbial issues. They're worried about if water could be a source of introducing bacteria or viruses or things like that into a crop. And we have seen that happen. It tends to be more the ones that have been identified, we see more in imported foods, but there have been things like hepatitis, you know, found in onions or berries or things like that, because dirty water or untreated water is used to either irrigate or process that crop. So this is looking at that system. One of the ideas is that you need more data, you need more testing to see, you know, if the water source a farm is using is good enough to irrigate a crop, but there's a cost for that. And that's, again, this is this balancing act of wanting to have a standard that will improve, you know, the public health performance, but not wanting to put people out of business with the cost of doing it. And this is this one needs more discussion, and it needs more debate, and FDA even admits they need more science to figure out what the right balance is. And so in this comment period that just ended, a lot of folks representing, you know, sustainable farms, organic farms, were saying you need to find ways where you're not crushing us with testing costs, and you know give us a rational way to learn more about our water. So we need to see more cooperation between different government agencies, because a lot of folks' water supply for their farm starts somewhere else, right? It doesn't just start at the border of their farm. There's got to be a way to get some more public data about water quality and things like that, so the burden doesn't fall, you know, too heavily on individual farms every year to do lots and lots of testing if they don't have a good economical way to do that.
Patty, thank you very much for sharing these updates, and we certainly support all the good work that Food and Water Watch is doing. The website is foodandwaterwatch.org. We will always keep our audience in the loop when it comes to these hearings, because we know of how much power Big Pharma and Big Ag has behind the scenes, because they're the ones who select Tom Vilsack and the head of the USDA, and Michael Taylor from Monsanto, who's head of food safety over at the FDA. So it's nice to know we have a public advocate in there. All the best to you.
Thanks.
Now, we're going to say hello to our talk back. Let's say hello to Benjamin from New York. Hi, Benjamin. You're on the air.
Hello, Gary. Based on what you were saying earlier, a huge percentage of Americans own their own homes. I know that from what I noticed, most people seem to shop in large chain stores. We're losing the middle class, and I think it's all interrelated on what you were saying before, because people don't have it. It's just a big, huge... rich against poor, it seems.
It's conscious versus unconscious, not rich against poor. We have a lot of rich people in America. We have almost 10 million millionaires. Could you imagine if those millionaires decided to engage, as many do, in social issues to help not just their class to protect it and what they've gained, but rather to correct imbalances in the larger society. A lot of poor people then end up eating the food that causes them or their family and children to become diseased. and then they can't afford the medical care, as bad as it is for chronic conditions like cancer and arthritis, diabetes, and heart disease, they then shop in stores that are selling cheap products that more often than not they don't need. Americans have been trained to believe that the purpose of their life is to consume so many. And as a result, we consume. At the high end, you consume very exclusive items, or you build mega mansions that have nothing to do with the reality of the value of what their intrinsic value is. Rather, it's the perceived value and versus what they really need. We need to learn a lesson from Buddhism, and all religions share insights that can help us. And this one is that at the end of life, have you learned how simple life has to be in order to be fulfilling? You can live an austere life and have all the richness of life within that austerity. Gandhi showed us that. Many others have shown us that. So just consumption. In the middle class, therefore, every time they go into a box store, are supporting the decimation of unions. They are destroying Made in America, the whole movement. They are exploiting factory workers, whether in Bangladesh or some other country. So we must also educate and share the true cost of what we're buying, where we're shopping, and what we're supporting. But we'll get into this in greater detail. Thank you very much, Benjamin, for calling in and sharing your comments. Now, we're going to hear from Nick Hanauer on rich people don't create jobs, and that's one of the biggest myths that we live with in our society.
How significantly one idea can shape a society and its policies. Consider this one. If taxes on the rich go up, job creation will go down. This idea is an article of faith for Republicans and seldom challenged by Democrats, and has indeed shaped much of the economic landscape. But sometimes the ideas that we are certain are true are dead wrong. Consider that for thousands of years, humans believed that the Earth was the center of the universe. It's not. And an astronomer who still believed that it was would do some pretty terrible astronomy. Likewise, a policymaker who believes that the rich are job creators and therefore should not be taxed will do equally terrible policy. I have started or helped start dozens of companies and initially hired lots of people. But if there was no one around who could afford to buy what we had to sell, all those companies and all those jobs would have evaporated. That's why I can say with confidence that rich people don't create jobs, nor do businesses large or small. Jobs are a consequence of a circle of life-like feedback loop between customers and businesses. And only consumers can set in motion this virtuous cycle of increasing demand and hiring. In this sense, an ordinary consumer is more of a job creator than a capitalist like me. That's why when business people take credit for creating jobs, it's a little bit like squirrels taking credit for creating evolution. It's actually the other way around. Anyone who's ever run a business knows that hiring more people is a course of last resort for capitalists. It's what we do if and only if rising consumer demand requires it. And in this sense, calling ourselves job creators isn't just inaccurate, it's disingenuous. That's why our existing policies are so upside down. When the biggest tax exemptions and the lowest tax rates benefit the richest, all in the name of job creation, all that happens is that the rich get richer. Since 1980, the share of income for the top 1% of Americans has more than tripled, while our effective tax rates have gone down by 50%. If it was true that lower taxes for the rich and more wealth for the wealthy led to job creation, today we would be drowning in jobs. And thank you. And yet unemployment and underemployment is at record highs. Another reason that this idea is so wrong-headed is that there can never be enough super rich people to power a great economy. Somebody like me makes hundreds or thousands of times as much as the median American, but I don't buy hundreds or thousands of times as much stuff. My family owns 3 cars, not 3,000. I buy a few pairs of pants and shirts a year like most American men. Occasionally we go out to eat with friends. I can't buy enough of anything to make for the fact that millions of unemployed and underemployed Americans can't buy any new cars, any clothes, or enjoy any meals out. Nor can I make up for the falling consumption of the vast majority of middle-class families that are barely squeaking by, buried by spiraling costs and trapped by stagnant or declining wages. Here's an incredible fact, that if the typical American family still retained the same share of income that they did in 1970, they'd earn like $45,000 more a year. Imagine what our economy would be like if that were the case. Significant privileges have come to people like me, capitalists, for being perceived as job creators at the center of the economic universe, and the language and metaphors we use to defend the current economic and social arrangements is telling. It's a small jump from job creator to the creator. This language obviously wasn't, this language was not chosen by accident. And it's only honest to admit that when somebody like me calls themselves a job creator, we're not just describing how the economy works, but more particularly, we're making a claim on status and privileges that we deserve. Speaking of special privileges, the extraordinary differential between the 15% tax rate that capitalists pay on carried interest, dividends, and capital gains, and the 35% top marginal rate on work that ordinary Americans pay, is kind of hard to justify without a touch of deification. We've had it backwards for the last 30 years. Rich people like me don't create jobs. Jobs are a consequence of an ecosystemic feedback loop between customers and businesses. And when the middle class thrives, businesses grow and hire, and owners profit. That's why taxing the rich to pay for investments that benefit all is such a fantastic deal for the middle class and the rich.
We would agree with that. That's Nick Hanauer. At a TED Talk. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day. Now let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hi, Gary. Today, a legal lynching caps a battle over Benton Harbor, Michigan.
Okay, Utrice Lead right now.